Did you hear it?
I did. Welcome to the MacGuffin Man, special holiday episode of the MacGuffin Man.
Yay!
I'm Alex, and wearing a Christmas hat in the other room is James. You can check out our website, themacguffinman.com, to get caught up on our previous episodes. We most recently talked about Last Action Hero, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, and Justice for All. I've also written a couple things recently, most recently something about Last Action Hero, because apparently we did not talk about it enough on the podcast, and something about the reception of Lady Bird that is also kind of about Lou Reed and Jay-Z, so go figure on that one. But themacguffinman.com, tell your friends, happy holidays. I'm going to break up some friendships by hating on Home Alone for a bit now. That theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
Christmas.
All right, James.
Yeah.
What are we talking about here today?
Well, you already pointed out the fact that we're going to be talking about Home Alone.
I did.
And a brief view of your take on it. And
my adult take. I will offer a positive challenge.
Okay. Yeah. And your anticipated reaction to that. Mm-hmm. And a two-hander with The Night Before.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to explain why you want to do these together, or you just want to start with one or the other?
I think it makes the most sense to sort of talk about Home Alone first, and then sort of talk about, because like Home Alone is pretty emblematic of Christmas movies that people our age would watch, and I think the thing that The Night Before does is sort of reframe a lot of the things that, like, I just can't attach myself to in Christmas movies anymore, just because I don't identify with characters like Kevin McAllister in any capacity, and just sort of reframes it in a way that the adult version of me can appreciate. So I think it's better to talk about Home Alone and then sort of talk about The Night Before through that sort of lens.
Yeah, and I mean, The Night Before talks about Home Alone. It's one that's very, you know, you're right in saying that this is kind of an updated version. Not that the plots are similar, but someone who watched Home Alone, who could have watched Home Alone when they were the target demographic of Home Alone, has now grown up, and Home Alone is still a part of Christmas along with a lot of other things, but Christmas is different and everything's different, which is what The Night Before is very much dealing with. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it makes sense chronologically to start with Home Alone, so let's do that.
Cool.
You liked it as a kid and have aged away from it gradually?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely liked it as a kid, and especially the last, like, 20 minutes. I do have memories of just watching that part a lot of times. I don't know how many times I'd actually seen the full movie, but definitely the sillies at the end I definitely watched a lot of times. But yeah, I definitely liked it as a child, and it's just as an adult, I can't say that I enjoy the movie. I was like happy to see that, when I did some research on the movie, that the reviews weren't super positive for it. For whatever reason, I just sort of always had it in my head that, critics liked Home Alone for some reason. But, I was nice to see that it was nice to see that like other adults agreed with me at the time. And that I just wasn't being totally grumpy, you know? Which I certainly have the capacity to be. But.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's worth pointing out that this was a huge movie. Like,
oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's still a movie that people watch.
It was the highest grossing live action comedy until The Hangover Part 2, I think. Which is crazy.
Which is completely true. Yeah. No, that's incredible.
21 years. Anyway.
Yeah. And when it came out, it was the third biggest movie, like, of all time without, you know, any of those qualifiers of live action comedy, right?
Yeah. Which just doesn't make any sense, you know? Like, it seems so impossible to me now, you know?
It is really wild. I mean, just without saying anything about the quality of the movie, just mm-hmm. that it's this kind of movie was the one that was that big. But it's just that it's so broad, right? Like, you could imagine it would play well anywhere. I mean, those numbers we were talking about are just in the United States, but you could imagine it would do well everywhere because, you know, some comedy doesn't, but this is especially that last little bit, so slapsticky, and even some of the gags throughout are pretty visual and easy to hold on to, no matter what culture. So there's that. And I guess it's just that when you're rated G, literally anyone can see this movie, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah, exactly.
It's just people like to go to the movies around Christmas, and people want to spend time with their families around Christmas. So it makes sense that you could sell 5 tickets at once because the whole family could go. And it's positive. Kids movies always have some kind of pro-social value, and this is about the togetherness of family. So I am a little bit surprised by, you know, some of the superlatives this gets as far as how well it did financially. Mm-hmm. But those reasons, I think, make a lot of sense. And it was a different time is also part of
that.
Yeah,
of course, of course.
Just you could open a big movie like this and expect this many people to come. Now, it exceeded expectations. No one thought it would be this big, and it would be pretty incredible if you could predict a movie being this big given what it was. Mm-hmm. And I think that, I don't know if it's still used anymore, but I know there was a term to be home aloned in the film industry, which is just to come out against something that is so huge that if you were released on a weekend that nothing else was coming out on, you had a chance. But if you choose a weekend that it just happens to be the same weekend as some big sleeper hit like this, yeah, is, you know, you're obviously just going to sell fewer tickets because people already know what they want to see and it's not your movie.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
So what, when did you turn on it?
I mean, if I had seen it at any point in the last 20 years, I'd be surprised. You know, I can't imagine I had seen this since the mid-90s, you know? So I did kind of get to watch it really with fresh eyes. Like, I didn't remember it very well, except for the last 20 minutes or so. I remembered the man next door or whatever. I forget his name, but...
The shovel murderer.
Yeah, luckily for me. Yeah, exactly. Luckily for me, I forgot about John Candy, so that was a nice pleasant surprise.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I totally forgot that Joe Pesci's just standing in the front hall of their house for 8.5 minutes at the beginning of the movie, and nobody seems to think this is weird. Because that's one thing that, like, right off the top, I was like, all right, this movie's trying to make me upset, you know? Like, it doesn't matter how many family members you have. There's just an unknown adult standing in the front of your house, regardless of whether or not he's dressed like a cop. Like, that's weird and needs to be addressed immediately. Yeah,
I think it's... I mean, there is 5,000 things we could pick apart about this movie.
Yeah, no, 100%.
Yeah, I think the cop outfit does a lot for that.
Yeah. Yeah, but I don't know. But I guess then it's just since it's right at the beginning, you know, that's the first of what is... many instances of weirdziness to come, I'm sure, but yeah.
And I mean, so with having forgotten John Candy, this is, I think everyone just assumes this is a John Hughes movie in every way, but it was not directed by John Hughes, but it is produced and written by John Hughes. Mm-hmm. And
a year after he wrote Christmas Vacation, by the way.
Yeah, so, and I kind of forgot about his, you know, maybe not full step, maybe half step away from Hollywood, because he moved back to Illinois. You know, he succeeded in, you know, pretty much every way you can for someone in his career. And then...
Yeah, he's still a cinematic icon now.
Yeah, and he just has... like, there's a John Hughes feel, you know? There's certain images and, you know, Illinois, Chicago, and, you know, people under the age of 17, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know, he still has kind of you know, this stream of things that you can point to as being John Hughes. So it's directed by Christopher Columbus, but yeah, as I said, this is, he was, you know, achieved a lot of things and then didn't retire, but moved out of LA and just, you know, lived in rural Illinois and still wrote and still, you know, was obviously in contact with the industry, but this is very much one of his works after that step away. And I kind of forgot that was part of, you know, his legacy.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, he had such an interesting career, even outside of the defining works that he made. Like, it's very easy to forget that John Hughes wrote Home Alone, because he's just not, it doesn't fit the mold of John Hughes movie in the way that The Breakfast Club does, because that's his most iconic movie. It's the movie that everybody thinks of first, you know? People think about teenagers. They don't think about 8-year-olds or however old Kevin is in this movie. So it's just easy to miss him. And also, basically, by virtue of this movie being released, Macaulay Culkin became more famous than John Hughes pretty quickly. So he became the most famous person to talk about, you know? Or the face of the movie, even outside of the fact that the poster is a center frame picture of his face.
yeah, and it was John Candy that kind of reminded me about the John Hughes connection, because they, you know, they had worked together and were very close, especially around this time, and was a neighbor of his in Illinois, and I think they only had John Candy for one day, and he came to the set, and I think they worked for like 21 hours or something. And John Hughes was just not on set very often, but he was there for almost the whole time that John Candy was there. And that's not a story that I really knew before I was researching this, but I think it speaks to that there is, you know, as you said, this isn't, you know, a John Hughes film in the way that Breakfast Club mostly, but 16 Candles and Pretty in Pink are John Hughes, right? Mm-hmm. This is kind of John Hughes light. And as I said, there's kind of those signifiers, like a John Candy's not that same kind of crew, but just in who he was in his life and some of the other films he made, and Illinois. But there's just this, like, a sincerity about John Hughes and something about genuine connection between friends and family that I think is, you know, obviously weaved all through this movie. And I think that, you know, just a story like that about him having a good friend there and even not really liking being on movie sets seemingly at this point in time, just the idea of spending time and connecting with somebody is just so quintessential John Hughes to me, and I think to a lot of people.
Yeah, absolutely. And it should be noted that as a director, John Hughes's last, like, really notable movie was Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, and Uncle Buck were the last two that were, like, movies that we still talk about in some capacity, you know, both of which star John Candy. So, you know, just sort of tie in your point to Hughes's actual directorial career. And you do sort of see elements of the Hughesian sort of feel to this movie, and just that what he's able to do, and this was always his best talent, was to sort of be able to put himself in the shoes of somebody so much younger than he actually was. And I remember there's this book by Susanna Gora. I can't remember what it's called, but it's very good. It's the best thing about John Hughes I've ever read. But there was this, he was friends with Ned Tannen, who was the head of, I think, Paramount throughout the 80s when John Hughes was at his peak. And I'm sure I told the story on the John Hughes podcast we did years ago, but Ned Tannen had a daughter who was about 15, and John Hughes would just, like, when he would call Ned Tannen, would end up talking to the daughter, and nobody thought this was weird. Like, and somehow, like, everybody's recollection of this still to this day is that, like, that's a totally okay thing to do because he was John Hughes and he was talking to 15-year-olds, and he just sort of understood what it was like to be a 15-year-old. And Home Alone is kind of that. But for, I'm going to keep saying 8-year-old unless somebody corrects me, but for an 8-year-old.
I have that number in my head too. So
okay.
I'm okay with that.
Also, any age under 30, I have found I'm just terrible at ballparking. So he might be 14 and I just don't know.
I'm sure he's not 14.
but that, the thing about this movie that, as an adult I watch, and can appreciate from, you know, a more educated cinematic perspective than I certainly had as a 4-year-old when this came out, is that the way that the movie sort of depicts the isolation of being a child and feeling like everybody's out against you, you know? And it's most notable in the scene, the kitchen fight sequence, where everybody just sort of blames Kevin for something that, you know, like, it's so minimal, and he gets so much ire directed at him for basically nothing. And just the way that he is then isolated from the family to go into that room by himself, the third floor bedroom, and then just sort of wishes his family away. You know, like that sequence and that feeling, I think that's the John Hughes element that really sticks out of this movie to me. Yeah.
No, I think
in a positive
true.
Way. I mean,
pardon?
In a positive way. I don't mean sticks out like pejoratively.
Yeah, no, and I mean, this movie is helped along by the fact that Macaulay Culkin is just like ridiculously charismatic beyond his years.
I kind of disagree with that, but I was one.
I'm bored with that.
So did I. And when I was watching this movie, there are parts where like I get it, and then there are just long stretches where I'm just like, I just don't like this kid. So I don't know. Go figure.
Yeah. No. That's interesting. I mean, I think it's so tough to have a movie centered around a young actor.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I just thought this was one that for the most, well, maybe it still is, for the most part, people are on board with, like, that you can have a movie with a kid at the center of it, and, you know, there's an idea that children just might not be the best judge of an actor's performance, and to have a kid at the center of it who isn't really great would detract less from a child's experience than the same thing with adults, right?
Yeah.
And I just think it's helped along by Macaulay Culkin being good. But yeah, there's, you know, not a ton of POV shots in this movie, but that one of everybody looking at Kevin, you know, after that fight with the milk and the pizza in the kitchen.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, like that's him being on the third floor shows the isolation, but just that shot of, you know, this slow camera movement of everybody just staring at him and either cleaning up or just crossing their arms and staring at him. Like that's the feeling of being a kid in trouble, right? Like just everybody staring at you and you having nothing to do or say or nowhere to go and just kind of dealing with the repercussions of doing something incorrectly.
Yeah, exactly.
Or what they have believed is incorrectly. I think he's in the wrong in this situation, but it got unfairly amplified by a couple like misplaced chairs and bottles of milk.
Yeah, absolutely. And also the fact that everybody's taller than him, you know, it sort of just sort of feels like they're all towering above you. There are like a handful of POV shots scattered throughout the movie. I remember one when he's talking to the grocery store clerk. They do try and every once in a while just sort of reposition the audience to see Kevin's perspective. And I think that's something, one of the things about this movie that I feel positively about. And also when he, just on the feeling of feeling isolated, when Kevin kind of accidentally steals a toothbrush, just doesn't really realize what he's doing.
Yeah.
As he's walking away and saying to himself, I'm a criminal, and he's walking home from the store, it's shot like on a really long lens and everything else around him's very out of focus. And, you know, this is not an exceptionally creative technique. I mean, it's most famously used in The Graduate, I think, probably to sort of show that sort of isolation and panic. But just the fact that they use that right in that scene when he really feels like he has alienated himself from the good side of society. You know, that's another moment where I was like, oh, cool. There's filmmaking in this kid's movie.
Yeah, and there's a few. I mean, I was just thinking about there's camera movement in this movie as well, and there's a couple dynamic shots of, you know, when that Kevin's lookalike is at the van and he's bothering all the van drivers and stuff. And there's one where he's in the front seat and we kind of pan across the windshield and see that discussion going on, and then we see the family coming out of the front door at the right time and then walking around it. And it's just, you know, it's just more technically complex than it really needs to be.
Mm-hmm.
And you and I both watched the famously dull but pretty good movie Stalker recently, which mm-hmm. we'll podcast about soon, and lots of still shots in that. And I was just thinking about kind of adult cinema and children's cinema, and if those shots are done, you know, just to kind of just to show off or to have that level of camera movement, even if there's no, you know, artistic motivation behind it, is done just to keep things dynamic, to keep things more interesting in a child's movie, to, you know, just basically prevent boredom and restlessness. Or mm-hmm. is there another reason that you can think of, or just kind of because it's cool looking and these people are talented enough to do it?
Exactly. I think it's more the latter. I don't think that, or at least there's nothing that jumped out to me about those shots where I was sort of like, oh, there is meaning here, you know? And
yeah, and I don't think there is.
No, exactly. And I think that, I mean, just sort of looking at Chris Columbus's career, the director of this movie, I don't know that we've mentioned his name yet. you know, not the most visually inventive person in the world. So I think it's just sort of like he seems to just sort of pick his spots. And most of the time he is somebody that just wants to make an engaging version. You know, he sees this stack of paper, there's a script in front of him, and he wants to make an engaging version, but he doesn't have these whole, these very complicated ideas of, we're always going to frame Kevin in the left of frame and everybody else in the right of frame to sort of feel, make it feel like Kevin's alone on the left side of frame. You know what I mean? Just that sort of like cinematic grammar, I don't think is something that Chris Columbus really tries to put into his movies all that frequently. You know, he just sort of picks his spots with those POV shots that we've discussed, and just sort of the uses a lot of the script to give you the feeling more than the actual shots.
Yeah, and there's a time when Kevin's walking around the house when he's discovered that, or right before, I guess, he discovers that he, quote, made his family disappear. But, you know, he's still looking around for them, and he walks into Buzz's room. I will point out now how much Buzz looks like my older brother, especially at the time of my life.
Oh, really?
Home Alone for the whole same haircut and everything. It's pretty funny.
Wow, I gotta see a picture of this.
Yeah. But anyway, he walks into his room, and there's, you know, the camera starts on the tarantula's terrarium, and he kind of skitters away, and then they move to the side, and we see Kevin walk in. It's kind of this just meandering camera movement while Kevin is literally meandering around his house trying to find people. And yeah, I mean, about Columbus, I mean, he's not making a ton of highly artistic movies, right? Like, he's good at what he does, but this isn't like that. Those kinds of camera movements aren't his bread and butter. And I think he just does enough to make this visually engaging.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And just as you were talking about the meandering around, I like the, maybe we're sort of talking about the same thing, but when Kevin just walks into the kitchen, sits down and puts on the television, is just sort of watching it by himself. Something about that actually like connected with me, and it sort of reminded me of my own childhood. Just being like alone as a child before anybody else is awake, and just sort of, I mean, that's not the case here, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And just sort of like sitting there and just being a total empty slate and just watching the television.
Yeah. And I think it adds just that this is a really nice big house too. Like, this, just that feeling of loneliness isn't the same if the McAllisters happen to live in an apartment in downtown Chicago, right?
Yeah,
like, it's
yeah.
just very opulent, big house that's, you know, it's just kind of got the huge open kitchen and the island and stuff like that. Like, it just, I see in that scene, especially the one that you were just talking about, of just, it's just nice, big, empty house. And we just have Kevin.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And do you think it's weird that Uncle Frank never gets his comeuppance? Like, I was looking at this from like a children's film kind of angle. And, you know, there's bad guys that get their comeuppance at the end, and it's just rare that we have someone who's kind of a dick. I mean, there's some funny stuff from Uncle Frank in this and the sequel, but do you think it's odd that nothing ever kind of comes from him stealing things and generally being a bad person?
No, I actually, I gotta say, one of my favorite parts of this movie is the fact that he never gets any sort of redemption, like with the family at the end when Buzz is like, cool, it's cool you didn't burn the house down, you know, like that moment where his family comes back. I was really happy for some reason that Frank's family didn't show up, because that just would have been too hokey for me.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I see the point that you're making. I guess it's just not something the adult me is on the lookout for, you know?
Yeah.
Just because I sort of understand that sometimes people are very obsessed with the free champagne on flights, and sometimes there's no comeuppance for such things besides too much bubbles in your tum-tums. So yeah, I can't say it jumped out at me. I got a kick out of the fact that he doesn't come back. He's just, Frank is just a piece of shit, is sort of what I came out of this movie feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. And, there is the theory that Uncle Frank is the one responsible for all of this.
Okay.
But
but can you detail this theory a little bit? Like, does he knock down the tree that takes out the power line or something?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to go full conspiracy theory, that in the shot of that tree coming down, you don't see the end of the branch, mm-hmm. as though it's not just weather doing this, but perhaps an evil uncle.
Oh my god.
And you know, when Kevin's home alone and they're in France and everyone seems pretty kind of bummed out and despondent, he's seemingly celebrating with a bunch of jumbo shrimp, and he's in a pretty great mood. Yeah, there's some other small things, but that's kind of the main one. And just the idea that he, you know, he's this third negative character who's not shown to be directly involved, but could be in this theory.
Yeah. All right. That's stupid.
Yes. I mean, it's just part of this movie being like so huge.
Yeah,
and
no, absolutely.
A constant for some people. Like, that stuff doesn't come up until you've seen it 30 times and spent some time thinking about this.
No.
Kind of bullshit.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I know I think that's stupid, but if there was a list in front of me of all the movies I have absurd theories about, simply because. By nature of, I don't know, The Rock being a James Bond movie, I think it's probably a good go-to for me, you know? Just, like, sometimes you just sort of develop these ideas in your head, having seen a movie enough times at a young enough age, but...
Yeah, and to get back to the sort of the lesson of this movie, and that in kids' movies, there's usually more of a lesson. Like, there's an arc in movies, you know, unless you're getting pretty, you know, more art house side, you know, something happens and there's something to be learned, but it's usually pretty straightforward in a kid's movie. Mm-hmm. This one is Kevin just feeling to be part of the family again, right? Like, it's not, you know, with The Night Before, and this kind of just shows how different, you know, how these are different movies for different age groups, that this one is not about him needing independence, but about him fitting into his family, you know, and like to feel love from his family and to give it back. You know, there are some movies about growing up and being independent, and there are some movies about just kind of fitting into a certain stage of your life, and this is one of those. You know, it's, you know, you can see a six-year-old Kevin being pissed off and, you know, claiming that he's going to run away from home. Mm-hmm. And this is a movie about just, you know, all those feelings, you know, something I'm sure John Hughes could relate to, all those feelings of, you know, wanting to run away and feeling that you're more independent and that these people don't treat you adult enough. But hey, you're 8 years old. You shouldn't be treated like an adult. And this mm-hmm. is about working your way into that fold, whereas The Night Before is about having that independence, right? Like, we're just a few life stages down the road by this point.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I do want to mention the just continuing on, because I do feel like this movie is about isolation more than just Kevin's feelings. Because one of the things that I enjoyed about this movie as an adult is the struggle that Kate goes through, his mom, trying to get back to Chicago, and just how isolated she feels by like any sort of paid employee at any point, you know, like of trying to get on a flight, or once she gets back to, I forget where she hitches the ride with John Candy, but wherever.
So does she.
Yeah.
It's Scranton.
Okay. Yes, of course. How could I forget? But yeah, in both of those sequences, the French woman I remember is Hope Davis for some reason. in both of those situations, it's just somebody like who just is unable and unwilling to even try to help, seemingly. And just the feeling of what must be going on in Kate's head, where she's like, I'm explaining this situation and people should be on my side here, or like at least putting in an effort to try and find another flight or something. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, sometimes you're just screwed. I understand that. But just the way that there seems to be a disconnect between the amount of effort anybody else is willing to put in until John Candy shows up, or other than that couple that's willing to trade tickets with her to get her to Scranton. But yeah, I don't know, the feeling of isolation that Kate feels, and also the murderous man with the shovel is a pretty notable example.
If we're
talking about things, the last thing I like about this movie a lot is the line, you can be too old for a lot of things, but you're never too old to be afraid. I think that's a fantastic line.
A few things. One, I've said this on another podcast, but I will reiterate it here because this is actually the place for it. I think Catherine O'Hara is fantastic in this movie.
In everything else.
Yeah, she is, but she does very few funny things in here, and we all know she can do funny things well. I think that for this pretty silly movie, she's mostly doing kind of dramatic chop stuff, and I think she absolutely crushes it.
Yeah.
So that's that.
Yeah. See our A Mighty Wind podcast for more Catherine O'Hara love.
For more like dramatic Catherine O'Hara love.
Yeah, exactly.
Because she is very good. And this, I've seen this movie, I'm going to say probably every year for many, many years now. But noticing John Candy in the back when she's explaining her story in Scranton, and he kind of like moves his head a little bit when he hears something really sad that she has just said. Mm. And I think I just noticed it more this time around, but it's actually a nice like little heartfelt moment thing. And John Candy is someone else who we know can do funny things, but part of what was so sad about his death, not just that he was pretty young, but is that it seems like he was just a really, really, really nice person too.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, kind of tying into that John Hughes thing again, it just totally seems like something we could see him doing is, you know, helping somebody out in this situation. And yeah, so I think emotionally their few parts together work very well, partially for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
And oh, I had
they also have the natural chemistry of longtime friends, you know, because they are longtime friends or were longtime friends.
Yeah, exactly. That's obviously a big part of it too.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, the scene of Catherine O'Hara, you know she says, kind of spends half this movie just in a panic trying to do the same thing, but yeah, there's that time, and I was reminded when you're talking about her just getting a lack of help from the employees, that, you know, she's done, or that man behind the counter is kind of done with her, and he reaches out his hand for the next woman to come up, and, you know, he starts helping her. And, you know, Kate steps aside, like, you know, this is how society works. Like, okay, this period of time is closed, I'm going to step off to the side. But mm-hmm. then there's that just parental instinct where she kind of like participates in their conversation a little bit and then jumps back in. Like, she knows she's acting outside of the realm of you know, social order, but is just obviously way too driven and has something that's very important to worry about. And mm-hmm. so she just interjects herself in a way that she knows is kind of rude or at least unexpected, but there's just kind of no stopping her at this point. And that's another thing I think that works well for her arc there.
Yeah. Yep. For sure.
Yeah. Did you know that this movie's huge in Poland?
I did not. I mean, I think we established that this movie's kind of huge everywhere, but
even by Home Alone standards, it's like huge. And, is aired all the time around Christmas, and then I think one station decided not to do it or announced that they weren't going to do it and just got a huge campaign against them, and so they eventually put it back on. And they kind of chalk it up to the result of being behind the Iron Curtain for so long, and mm-hmm. that some, you know, a lot of American cinema just wouldn't make it in, and this is one that is about being, you know, the David against Goliath, being the smaller one fighting back. And I think that kind of strikes something in the Polish national consciousness, and it really resonates with them in a way that, you know, everybody kind of likes this movie, but they kind of have this deep affection for it. And I just find that very curious and interesting.
Yeah, I can support that.
Mm-hmm. Anything else about Home Alone, or do you want to get to Night Before?
Goodfellas and Home Alone came out 2 months apart from each other, so that's like the last thing, because we haven't talked about Joe Pesci or Daniel Stern at all. And the thing that got me through the parts of Home Alone I really didn't like was being like, hold on, Goodfellas came out this same year, right? And then sort of piecing together that they must have come out mere months apart from each other. And I just loved the idea, because he must have shot them back to back, Pesci. I love the idea of him either going from the Goodfellas set to the Home Alone set or vice versa. Both of those ideas are fantastic to me.
I don't know which one's funnier to me.
Right? It's just equally funny. Like, because either way, it's just such a tonal shift. And also in my head, I kind of assumed that this was Home Alone was a movie. I thought Home Alone came out in like 92 or something. And it was the movie that he got out of Goodfellas. And that is not the case. He had them both simultaneously, and it makes it so much more entertaining to me.
Yeah, and you wonder if one of them would have prevented him being in the other one, right?
If there's enough space. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think it's kind of notable that Goodfellas wasn't a huge hit, so maybe that wouldn't have happened immediately. So, but yeah, who knows?
A regular Michael Madsen, Free Willy.
Yeah, exactly. That's yeah, exactly.
Famously.
There's nothing about Michael Madsen that isn't super famous. So, got anything more about Home Alone before we move on to the Alex side of this twofer?
Well, if you want to talk about gangsters, I will take 30 seconds to point out that the Angels with Filthy Souls, the film within the film of Home Alone, is wonderful. The one in the sequel is great too. Everything that comes as a result of that is great. And
I remember
to point out
that and the moments from the sequel extremely well.
Yeah, it's very funny. And just that they like use black and white film stock to film that and had like a ridiculous amount of authentic like 1940s era weapons and like set design for something that almost nobody cared about.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, exactly.
I will just put that there and leave it.
I can support it. I mean, it's one of the few things about this movie that stuck in my head, or that I actually remembered, you know? And same with the sequel, which I remember almost nothing about other than I feel like it was basically the same, except there was a bird lady instead of a shovel man, you know?
And an American president.
Yeah.
I don't know. We'll do.
There's no chance.
we'll do Home Alone and the Night After when it's.
All right. That I can support.
All right. Night Before.
Yeah. The 2015 Jonathan Levine film. I love this movie. I just love it so much. We just watched it together mere hours ago. I also watched it last night, and I don't know. I could watch it three more times before Christmas, which is 3 days from now, you know?
Yeah, so. And similar to this being a John Hughes movie, this is a Seth Rogen movie, you know what I mean? Not directed by Seth Rogen, but when you say a Seth Rogen movie to somebody, it means some things, and this fits in there.
Yeah, it's like a Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg, but I know what you mean.
But people don't really know Evan Goldberg as well.
The and Evan Goldberg is like quietly implied in my head every time somebody says something like that, even though I know most people don't know who he is.
Yeah, and I mean, that it is an important distinction because Evan Goldberg does a lot of work on these things to make them what they are. And, you know, this is a Seth Rogen movie in the way that whatever fucking Steve Jobs or whatever that one was called is not a Seth Rogen movie, right? Yep. Like there's movies Seth Rogen's in, and then there's Seth Rogen movies, and this is a Seth Rogen movie.
Yeah, through and through. I mean, him and Evan Goldberg were producers. Evan Goldberg is a credited writer on this movie. And yeah, it just has a lot of the hallmarks of one of those movies. And I mean, I've said it before in words that I've written and probably on this podcast, I sometimes feel like Seth Rogen is my emotional spirit animal because there's something about the way he is able to, I mean, he's slightly older than us, but the way that he's able to translate human emotions into a movie I can actually watch and like feel some sort of emotion for without feeling like it's corny. I don't know. There's something that him and Evan Goldberg have in their brains where they are able to be like authentically emotional human beings, but also translate that into comedy that I never find corny. And I just like, I am consistently surprised every time I see one of their movies, how attached I can get to something that just sort of seems like it should just be a comedy, you know? And I mean, the same team worked on 50/50, directed by Jonathan Levine as well, which I think is a fantastic movie. And it's just, I don't know, the things they mine out of movies that could so easily be so hacky, I just think are wonderful, you know?
Yeah. And is there anything else kind of on a broad, you know, loose checklist of a Seth Rogen, Evan Goldberg movie?
I mean, friendship is a big part of it. Constantly dealing with aging is another part of it. Which I think are, like, those are two things I care about and think about a lot. So it's not surprising that movies about those two things speak to me in some way. But these are comparatively smaller things, or one of these is definitely comparatively small, but the appreciation of hip hop, I can always get behind.
I think that's totally on the checklist.
Yeah, especially the use of Christmas and Hollis in this movie, Run DMC's Christmas in Hollis. Like, that was the first rap song I ever liked, because that song came out when I was 3 and was on a Christmas album and was the only rap song I'd heard at that point. So I sort of view that as like an important song in my own the history of my own tastes.
And bonus Die Hard connections out of that. But
exactly. Well, yeah, also that, which I did discover later. And also the other thing I appreciate about Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg's movies is how frequently they deal with male sexuality in a way that's just like, I don't know, that they're willing to treat it as something that's fluid. I find that very, very enjoyable, especially like the scene where, and I know Seth Rogen's so high in this scene when,
not Isaac, but Seth Rogen.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Okay. Isaac and Ethan are talking. Ethan's Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character. It's when, Isaac still doesn't know why he's getting dick pics. He's just chatting back and forth with who we will soon find out is James Franco.
Is it James Franco for sure?
I'm pretty sure it's supposed to be James Franco.
Okay.
They never say James Franco, but I think that's what it's supposed to be. I mean, regardless, it's.
Oh, and he is credited as himself.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, there it is. Yeah. But yeah, when Ethan asks Isaac, "Are you gay?" And then follows up with, "Are you curious?" And Isaac yells, "Everybody is." That's one of my favorite lines in the movie. And it's so funny, especially because for so long, comedy came like mined so many jokes out of homophobia. And including scenes featuring Seth Rogen, famously in one of his first famous roles is the, you know, how I know you're gay scene, in 40-Year-Old Virgin. And I like the way that, he's able to sort of, or him and Evan Goldberg are able to sort of embrace that and just talk about it in an interesting way, you know?
Yeah. Do you think they would do that scene again? Like, do you think that they've grown out of a kind of those more straightforward gay jokes? And now that this is not, I don't know, this just feels, not woke, you know what I mean? But this feels a bit more, inclusive.
Yeah, well, I mean, the 40-Year-Old Virgin came out in 2005, and The Night Before came out in 2015, so it's 10 years more inclusive. And also, Seth Rogen's probably 20 when they're making the 40-Year-Old Virgin. Because a consistent thing that people do not realize about Seth Rogen is that he's always younger than you think he is in any given movie. Like, he just looks older than he is. I mean, now he kind of looks his age, but like when he was 20, he looked 35.
Yeah. And he had such a young start, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, and I mean, like, I just can't imagine an Apatow movie in 2017 featuring the You Know How I Know You're Gay scene.
Yeah. Yeah.
Despite the fact that we all laughed at it in 2005, you know? So yeah, I do think just The Night Before in general comes from a more inclusive place that, again, ties into the fact that Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg are constantly in touch with the fact that they are aging and that their opinions on things change, but that the core concepts of the things that they care about don't, you know?
Yeah, and can we put drugs on the checklist?
Oh, yeah. That's a good point.
Yeah, okay. And so, on that note, you know, the plot of this movie is that this is their last party Christmas, right? Mm-hmm. That this is the last, you know, C-Rob is now a famous athlete who can't be partying like this anymore. Although his arc is a little inconsistent, we can kind of touch on later if you want. Yeah. And Isaac is about to have a kid, and he is a lawyer, I'm guessing, is what he gets said once and never mentioned again.
Yeah, it does get said once. I think it gets said two times. Jillian Bell says it earlier in the movie when she says she's proud of him, and then he yells it later.
Okay. Yeah. So this is kind of like the last shebang. They're all going to get fucked up one more time, and then they're going to, you know, hopefully all be grown up by the next year. And it kind of ends up that that's the case. We learn in the final sequence. Mm-hmm. Is there a meta level to this, that maybe this is Seth Rogen grown up movie? Like, that this, maybe we're not going to have another mushroom trip movie or sequence in some upcoming movies. Like, he can still be silly and have fun, but maybe that this is intentionally kind of a growth film.
I mean, that wouldn't surprise me. I mean, I think I always think his movies are about something. Like, a movie that he has any sort of creative control is always about something going on in his life or something that he's thinking about. Like when Neighbors came out, I'm sure we talked about this, the first Neighbors, I was like, I assume Seth Rogen will have a kid within the next year, you know? It felt like that was a movie about him dealing with the idea of being a parent.
Again,
but like at an age, because he was like 23 when Knocked Up came out.
And this is more of a, Neighbors was more of a deliberate, seemingly, let's have a family.
Exactly. He wasn't like a, yeah, exactly. I could see that being true. I don't know that it is yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if it ended up being true, you know?
Yeah. I just thought.
No, I do think there's always some sort of meta level to a Seth Rogen, Evan Goldberg movie. 100%.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Even outside of Miley Cyrus and James Franco playing themselves.
Yeah, because I mean, Neighbors, as much as it was about, you know, this role of him growing up and I don't know, This Is the End and some other things being about growth, I mean, as you said, that's number one on the checklist because I think it is so consistent. And you know, you could do a Seth Rogen movie without drugs. I'm sure it's happened. I can't think of what it is, but
the one with Barbra Streisand, probably.
Which one?
Guilt Trip with Barbra Streisand, probably.
There you go.
But I don't know that I don't know that Yentl would be smoking blunts with them.
Yeah, I just mean that, you know, you could take, I think, one or two of these other things off our admittedly very loose checklist and still have something that you could see as a Seth Rogen movie. But the growth thing seems so central.
Yeah.
And that maybe this is it, like in those other ones, even though they're about adulthood and growth, they're still kind of silly wild party movies where for the most part. Mm-hmm. And maybe this is, we'll be able to look back in 10 years and kind of see this as a very probably fluid but line in the sand.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can see that happening. And I mean, like, we just have to go back to the first Seth Rogen, Evan Goldberg movie, Superbad, which is just a party movie. But the thing that people sort of found in that movie that didn't exist in other similar movies was that scene at the end where they're like, well, Michael Cera and Jonah Hill's characters are legitimately sad to be leaving each other, you know? And That's the thing about that movie that is the Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg sort of thing. And the thing that I like so much about the way that they're able to sort of have a conversation about their own aging through their movies is that Seth Rogen's just always viewed as somebody who's like in a sense, sort of like in a in Arrested Development in some sort of capacity, you know, like just from the outside looking in, he's just sort of viewed as this stoner dude that just doesn't really grow up. And he's, I mean, presumably still smokes a lot of weed. But he still has the capacity to grow up while still smoking weed. And I just enjoy the way that his actual work really flies both in step with the perception of him and also totally against it simultaneously. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
As contradictory as that sounds, like he simultaneously plays into what we expect him to do and goes exactly against how people talk about him. And I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that does make sense though.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a Pete Rock and CL Smooth movie song that starts and ends this movie, and I'm all for it.
Yeah, I mean, even Isaac's arc in this one is kind of counterintuitive, right? Like, it's this idea that he's not as ready as he claims, right? I mean, to talk about, you know, you're saying what you appreciate him doesn't sound like it makes sense, but I think it does. Like, this is one where, you know, if this movie is about growing up, his part of this is about admitting that you're not completely ready to grow up, but you're doing what you can to deal with it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
Yeah. Like he kind of has a different thing. I mean, they're all, I guess all three of them are kind of dealing with something similar. Chris Roberts, less so.
Yeah.
Well, he just has the least amount of story in this, and what, he owns up to steroids and that's that. Like, it's just, there's not much there for him to work with.
Mm-hmm. I mean, his relationship with his mother, that's the, and I think the woman playing his mother does a lot of the heavy lifting there. I think she does so much with basically nothing. I think she's really impressive in this movie.
Yeah, it's just, it's the third that we have the less to hold on to, right?
Yes. I mean, I'm kind of surprised we've been talking about Isaac this much, to be honest.
Yeah, it's true.
I mean, it is a movie about Ethan and then Isaac and then Chris, you know?
Yeah, and I'll just say like that. So Isaac kind of has something different than Ethan going on, even though it's both about growing up. Isaac, seemingly that part of being an adult is, you know, doing everything you can to be prepared for the next stage of your life, but being honest enough with yourself and your partner to kind of let on that you're not completely ready, you know, like you're willing to do everything, but you're not always 100% confident in your ability. And yeah. Ethan just isn't ready to take any of those steps. Isaac is learning to kind of show a bit of his weakness, and Ethan's weakness is just not being able to take any further steps because he's not completely confident, right?
Yeah, I mean, also Ethan's weakness is to not be able to share his weakness with anybody, whereas I think part of what makes Isaac more his life has more progress, even aside from the fact that he is an expectant father, is that he is at the end of the movie willing to share his emotions with his wife. And that conversation that him and Jillian Bell have in the hospital at the end of the movie, I think is really important in that it's just sort of them, despite the fact that they have already committed to spending their lives together, are still learning stuff about each other and willing, still feel scared about saying things to each other. But when they do, share their own fears, that it is a positive on the whole. And the thing that Ethan has to learn is that he kind of needs somebody to tell these things to, you know?
Yeah, Isaac dealing with his fears about fatherhood is initially him literally looking at himself in his phone. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, it's this very insular venting where he just screams out loud and maybe we'll watch it later back at himself. And eventually the growth is him turning that phone around and showing it to his wife, you know,
yep.
and then talking about everything, but externalizing these fears to the person he should be externalizing them to.
Yep.
And we get there, you know, Ethan isn't even willing to do that much initially, right? Like, he won't even talk to himself about it. Seemingly wouldn't even think about what it is that's bothering him. We know, as they say in the movie, he's kind of very right to be upset about, you know, this tragedy that came to him in his youth. But
yeah, because his parents were killed by a drunk driver.
Yeah, but he kind of can't dwell on that and has to start looking at himself. And by the end of the movie does, and even is open about it with whatever Lizzie Kaplan's character is called.
I think it's Diana, right?
Yeah, there you go.
Look at me, knowing character names.
Oh, it happened. It finally happened.
Yeah. Hey, man, I knew the name of the mom from Home Alone without prompting. So. I mean, it's helpful that is my mom's name. But
and kind of Catherine O'Hara's name.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, and I mean, if we're to tie this into Home Alone in just sort of the way that, because like, I don't like Christmas movies because they're about Christmas. I just don't.
You like Die Hard?
I don't want to have this argument, but like, I don't view Christmas as integral to Die Hard. I don't view Die Hard as a Christmas movie in the way that I view Home Alone as a Christmas movie. But I know that I'm in the minority there, and it's a boring argument that I have no interest in having.
Okay, wait. Can I say one thing?
Yeah.
I think that less than a lot of Christmas movies, I think Home Alone is less about Christmas than a lot of Christmas movies.
Yeah, like, okay.
It's not about the miracle of Christmas. It's not about religion. It's not about like it's about being with your family, but not so much that it wouldn't make sense at another time of the year.
Yeah, and I feel the same way about Die Hard. Also, I view the release date as so important to whether or not something is a Christmas movie. Like, Home Alone partially is a Christmas movie because it was released in November, and Die Hard isn't because it was released in July. You know, like, those are things that I just sort of feel are important. I think I realize that over time those things matter less, which is why I sort of over time have lost the argument that didn't exist 20 years ago. But like, the Die Hard argument, I realize I'm on the wrong side there. But yeah,
history.
That's sure. but like The Night Before is obviously a Christmas movie, and in that it was marketed as such, and is so explicitly about Christmas. But yeah, just like I don't like movies that are about Christmas just to be about Christmas. I like movies like anything else. I like movies where I can see something that I can identify with. And I mean, when we were talking about Home Alone, there's just nothing in that movie that I feel like I can really identify with. And the way that The Night Before plays with a lot of tropes of Christmas movies, or just sort of these idealized versions of holidays, or romances or whatever. And I just find that that is a version of a movie about Christmas that can really speak to me. It's like that, Bad Santa, and Jingle All the Way. Those are like the Christmas movies that, that like I like. Apparently there's one every decade. But like, They're movies that like I can engage with on some level that doesn't necessarily have to involve Christmas. And I think there's a real interesting, the way that The Night Before toys with reality and sort of like what we expect out of these Christmas movies, and the fact that like we're okay with some fantastical elements existing.
like Michael Shannon being an angel who's also Santa's son.
I mean, like there's so little to say about Michael Shannon in this movie other than, like Miley, he was flawless. like it's so fantastic that he's in this movie. He's unbelievably enjoyable in this movie. Each of his scenes, he's funnier than the last, with the exception of the brief one at the end where he just sort of flies away. But like he's funny in the first scene with Chris. He's like borderline hilarious in the second scene with Seth Rogen, and just show stopping at the end when he's talking about Leo and Miley and crying over JGL's story. But just sort of the way that you know, between that character and the Grinch are the characters that sort of explicitly play with the idea of like, this can't be real, sort of thing. And but like from a more real grounded perspective, I love the marriage proposal scene for that same reason, because like that's so stupid. What he does is so stupid.
Yeah.
What Ethan does is like idiotic. And I love the fact that Diana says yes only to get out of the situation to then say no. Something about that feels so truthful to me. Yeah. I have never proposed to somebody with Miley Cyrus singing backup for me, so I don't know necessarily that is what would happen. But like, there's just something about that whole sequence that feels like there's a version of this in Love Actually. Is not a good example because there isn't a scene like this in Love Actually, but like something like that where people just love it because it's like, it's a lovey-dovey sort of movie, where somebody like spills their heart out with a pop star singing behind them, where they say yes and then they get married, everybody's happily ever after. But that's just like in the parameters of the situation, that should never happen. Like Diana would be stupid to say yes. Just
this,
like,
movie is 30% worse if she says yes and means it.
I would say 75% worse. But like, and there's that, and also just the way that when he does come to her door at the end, and this is such a small thing as well, but like how the way that like right before they kiss, they're talking about just the dumbest thing in the world, about how they're gonna have sex with Diana's parents. And I just found that I've always found that sort of that just absolute inane conversation that happens before you kiss somebody, I think that's always so poorly reflected in movies, and I just love that in this one.
So we're obviously on the same page, and this doesn't surprise me at all that the proposal was handled well.
Yeah.
It realistically, because who wants to disappoint Miley? I think that it's too much that she lets him into her house, though.
Yeah, I get that.
Okay.
Yeah,
because saying yes to the proposal would make this way worse. Her inviting him in, I think, makes this a bit worse.
Okay.
I don't like it. I mean, I won over in general by this movie, but that I don't like. I don't think it's very believable that he even goes there. Like, I think he would still be so kind of cringing and apologetic about what he had done to her already, to kind of put her on the spot now in front of her family, I think doesn't ring true to me at all.
Okay.
So that's a little like, it's like a tiny version of the proposal scene that doesn't exist where she says yes and means it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a little bit too much. But like, I think we, you know, you and I both loved the end of 500 Days of Summer where he doesn't get it, but there's this optimism. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what this movie needed. I think that that's a little too sweet. And I know I was just defending everything about Home Alone, so maybe I lost my too sweet street cred. But yeah, that's a little too much for me.
Okay. Well, I mean, I was rooting for homeless Shovelman to not reconcile with his with his kid, and I mean, he's not homeless. Shovel Murder Man.
He has a beard. He's homeless.
In Home Alone. Yeah. If you had a beard in 1990, you were probably homeless. It's true. So yeah, I get what you're saying. And the one other thing that I mean that kind of ties into the sort of the way that this movie sort of doesn't necessarily exist in reality, but sort of more from a stylistic perspective, because I do think this movie is really well directed. I think Jonathan Levine is a good director who's had a real up and down career. Like 50-50 is a fantastic movie, as I've mentioned. The Whackness is okay. I haven't seen every one of his other movies, but you know, just sort of has an up and down career. But this is one where I think he does a fantastic job. The cinematography is great. I love the way that there just seem to be like really hot light sources all throughout scenes where, you know, a character, the one that I'm picturing in my mind is when the last flashback when Seth Rogen and Anthony Mackie show up at JGL's apartment after his parents have died on that first Christmas. And there's just a light right above Seth Rogen and his head is just like the top of his head is just fully overexposed. And these light sources exist all throughout the movie. And it's like going against the rules of cinematography to do this. And yeah. It just sort of like parts of the scene are just totally overexposed. Parts of characters' faces are totally overexposed. And I think it just sort of, one, to tie in with the whole drug thing, if you're really high, lights make it like look like things are overexposed, which I thought was like a nice element. And also just like this sort of stylistic element that would never exist in real life, but doesn't feel too stylish to take you out of the movie. And also just in general, I'm all for comedies that try to do something stylistic with the with their cinematography. And I think this is a movie that at least tries something. And it's a lot of really beautiful anamorphic cinematography, a lot of really wide angle lenses that just sort of have a lot of distortion that are really cool. And a lot of cool decisions are made. And I think Jonathan Levine deserves a lot of credit for that, because the cinematographer for this movie is Brandon Trost, who is just like the go-to guy for these sorts of comedies. His most recent movie is The Disaster Artist, which is not an inventively shot movie at all. It's a very good movie. It's a very enjoyable movie. It's just not inventively shot. And I just sort of think that it's just such a cool, like, small creative touch to add to this movie. And even when they're sitting on that pier at the end of the movie, the three guys talking about how it's harder to stay friends when as you age, in some pretty obviously 80-yard lines. I like the idea. I wish they could have figured that out on set instead of in a recording booth.
It's like when Kevin is running away from the camera and says, "I've got to protect my house." That this is a direct reference to that part of
Home Alone. Oh, for sure. There's also some really hilarious ADR in The Night Before, which I appreciate. Like Jillian Bell saying it's all the drugs in the world is definitely ADR and definitely hilarious. So I mean, you win some, you lose some. But just the way that they're like their faces are borderline underexposed and everything around them is so hot, like so overexposed, and it's just this weird sort of look that does not exist in modern comedy. And I just love that they tried anything. There are a couple small oneers that I really enjoy that just sort of let the actors work. I always feel like comedies deserve credit for trying something in cinematography, in that as much as I love Judd Apatow, one of the unfortunate things he did for comedy was just sort of have the most boring cinematography in the world in his early movies. Trainwreck's a really well shot movie. I'm all for people trying stuff, and I just think this movie deserves credit for it. Yeah.
Yeah, and you get a Kubrick homage with The Shining twins.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like they do the shot perfectly.
Yeah, exactly.
Which helps.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think with those kind of one takes, like it gives that, and I know this movie, the comedy parts, I think, were kind of pretty fast and loose and improvised. And yeah, I think those shots like that give you, you know, obviously if you're improvising something, you can do that. And it just gives it like that hanging out with friends vibe, right?
Yeah.
Like it just feels like a, you know, a hangout more than too much cutting. But yeah, the idea of them actually trying something visually is obviously great. And I mean, that we kind of talked about it a little bit, but how much this movie borrows, you know, like certain music from like, I mean, they directly talk about Home Alone and Die Hard, often very comedically. You know, she Home Alone to me, I think, is probably one of my favorite parts of this movie.
That they follow it up by saying, are those micro machines, is so funny.
No, that's great. And so I think with a movie that is aware of these other pieces of cinema, I think it is important that they have to think about this movie as cinema and not just a storytelling way, but in a visual way as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, just to give a couple examples of scenes where these things happen, like the most notable sort of longer wide angle take is when Chris and Isaac go to meet Ethan on the F train, and we just sort of follow them down the stairs, and then we go over to Ethan. They see that he's been punched in the face by Jason Mantzoukas, and they have a conversation that then a train comes in and they get on the train, you know, like that's just you're coordinating a subway train, you know, to work within in your take. And I just love that level of effort in a comedy. And the other notable one is the flashback that I talked about the overexposure over Seth Rogen's head, as that tease that as an example. But like when they show up to his door, and then for close to a minute, the conversation that they have before we get a cut, it's probably close to a minute of just the three of them talking about the situation and just sort of sitting in what would just be a very awkward situation for all of them, because none of them quite know how to react in that situation, because presumably it's the first time either of them, any of them have been in that exact situation. You know, it's just, it's a hard situation to know what to do in, just because you don't have a lot of opportunities to be in that situation, hopefully, you know, like, and I think it's notable that of the three people in this movie, only one of them is seen as a comedian first. Like Anthony Mackie and Joseph Gordon-Levitt are like actors, and Seth Rogen is a comedian who can act. Whereas JGL and Anthony Mackie are actors who can be funny. And I just sort of think that adds a little element to the movie that I think is so important, just that it's not Seth Rogen and necessarily two people you would expect to be in a Seth Rogen movie. After 50-50, it's not surprising that JGL played the lead in this movie. But Anthony Mackie, I never would have predicted would be playing this role. And I think that's another nice element, that you just sort of add people who can actually act so that you can sell the more dramatic elements of the movie, you know, and then you can still have the Jason Mantzoukas moments where he gets to be hilarious and call people dum-dums. You know?
Yeah, no, I mean, as much as I dislike, as I said, one of the choices that they make in that final scene with Lizzie Kaplan and JGL, it's a good acting scene. You know what I mean? Like, I have plot issues with it, but that scene, you're just like, oh, these are just two good dramatic actors with good chemistry that can bounce off each other really well. And yeah, just to kind of back up what you're saying, you know, I said that when they do those longer takes, it does feel like that hangout movie, and this is a movie about friends and hanging out, but there is obviously that other negative side that you're talking about, and there's that sadness that you share with friends. And yeah, to dwell on that moment, as you were talking about, of that unpleasantness, you know, when they're first talking about what they're going to do on Christmas now that his parents are gone. Yeah, you dwell in that part as well. You know, that's the other part of friendship, is to literally like just be around and to kind of have these moments play out as they would.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to tie it all together as best as possible, like, I think one thing that this movie does really well is I really like the closing 1 year later scene. And I don't even think Run DMC is important to this. I love just the song that they used to do karaoke is what they're now singing to the baby. I think that's like such a small, wonderful moment. And just sort of in a movie that's about time progression, and also just sort of holding on to the things that you really care about in your life, as opposed to the partying aspects of friendship. I think that's really cool. And I think it puts a really nice bow on it. And also, you know, like there are just elements of this movie outside of it that I think probably sort of hit me when I was watching it the first time. Well, I know because I think this was the first time, and I didn't know Tracy Morgan was in this movie, but this is the first time after Tracy Morgan's accident where he was back on screen in anything that I'd really seen. And it's just reminding you that, I just didn't expect to see Tracy Morgan, and just to see him after having been through a traumatic car accident or truck accident, I suppose, and just to sort of have him put a hilarious bow on this movie and open the movie with his voice. It just sort of further drives home points about real existence in the world of comedy. And I just will always be impressed by how Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg and Jonathan Levine as well are able to collectively capture that sort of, we're making an absurd comedy, but it's an absurd comedy about real life. And I don't know, it just, more credit should be given to people that are able to pull that off, because it's incredibly difficult.
Yeah. Okay. Do you think that's enough credit?
Seth Rogen's the new Stanley Kubrick. Now it's enough.
There it is.
Yeah. Canadian Kubrick. There we go. But yeah, thank you for listening to the McGuffman, and happy holidays.